Hello, and welcome to this Innovation Forum webinar with me, Ian Welsh. Today we are going to consider sustainability for agriculture and what sort of innovation we need to feed future generations for the long term. We will discuss how cross-sector collaboration and investment can drive the innovation and technology that will scale solutions for farmers, the food industry, consumers, and the environment. It's clear that as the planet's population increases and natural resources are put under ever more pressure, the agriculture industry faces the central challenge of how to grow more crops efficiently and sustainably. And more money went into funding agriculture technology startups in 2017 than the previous 2 years combined. But will this surge of agri-tech solutions and investments provide answers that consumers and food companies are looking for? What are other technologies that will scale sustainable solutions for feeding future generations? In this webinar, we have two experts to help frame discussion on how brands can work with their suppliers and farmers to develop sustainable agriculture solutions. And I'm delighted to be joined by Ashley Allen, Climate and Land Senior Manager with Mars, and Dr. Kevin Kephart, Head of Industry Relations with Indigo Ag. And my thanks to my Innovation Forum colleague, Azadeh Ardakani, for helping to convene our panel. The issues we'll be covering today will be discussed further at Innovation Forum's conference asking, Can Innovation and Technology Make Agriculture Sustainable? Conference held in partnership with the Nature Conservancy on April 5th and 6th in Washington, D.C. Full details of this interactive and engaging event are on Innovation Forum's website and the address is in front of you, where you can sign up now for best price passes. Hope to see you there. Well, back to today. I will shortly invite our panelists to make some opening remarks to kick things off. We will then have some follow-up discussion and I will open up the debate to audience questions, particularly during the second half of our hour. We do really want to hear from you, so please submit questions using the questions box on the webinar dashboard and I will put them to our panel. Questions can be directed to all the panel or to one panelist in particular, and if you can keep them short and sweet, it is more likely that I will use them. So, turning to our panel, Kevin, I thought you perhaps could go first. Please, can you outline Indigo Ag's work and in particular, what you are doing with the farmers and agriculture sector to deliver increased farm profitability while decreasing the use of inputs? Kevin.
Thank you very much, Ian. Thank you for the introduction and it's a pleasure to be here. And I'm hoping the electronic technology is working out for this webinar. My name is Kevin Kephart. As I've been introduced, I've been with Indigo a fairly short period of time. I started as head of industry relations back in August of 2017, and that was after 30 years of being in South Dakota State University as a professor and administrator and vice president during that time. Indigo is a new company. We call ourselves a startup company. We still are. We were founded in 2014, and even though we are a startup company, we have great technology, and we've been able to attract a lot of investment into our company. Most recently, our total has been about $400 million of private equity funds that have been raised and brought up the company to get it established and get its business plan underway. We have offices in Boston. That's where our main headquarters is and where most of our lab scientists are, but we also have a commercialization office in Memphis, Tennessee. That's our point of our anchor point where we go from there to reach out to the agricultural community that we're working with. Recently, we've opened up other offices in Buenos Aires, in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and Sydney, Australia as well. And about this time last year, before I was brought on, we had just under 100 employees. And today we have over 250 and we'll be growing to others as well. The crops that we tend to focus on or that we are focusing on right now to support farmers are include cotton, corn, soybeans, rice, and wheat. And particularly at this point in time, winter wheat, hard red winter wheat, but we'll be expanding into others. I think the most important thing on the webinar that I want to emphasize is what the mission of the company is. And then we'll talk about how we address our mission. And that's really key to the culture that we have in Indigo. because each and every important business decision, every initiative, or every activity that we have links back to this three-point mission that we have. First of all, the mission of Indigo is to bring about technologies and support that increase profitability for farmers. We have an ever-changing world of agriculture, especially the last few decades. We've had increasing yields, but we've observed and we've analyzed that the cost of those technologies that have been brought into agriculture in some cases have increased by 400%, whereas the amount of yield realized is considerably lower than that 400%. And so we're very mindful of that. Second of all, and maybe perhaps of importance to our webinar today, we want to improve sustainability. We want to bring about technologies that reduce the impact and demand on natural resources in farm country. And then finally, since we are talking about agriculture and production, we want to make sure that commodities or products that we produce, grains for food or other processes, or cotton for fiber, meet consumer demands. And we really take traceability and identity preservation to heart. I want to touch upon our technology first. And there's two areas that I want to talk about on what the activities of the company are and how we address our mission. First of all, we're a company that is putting forth technology, effort, and expertise on bringing about the plant microbiome. Now, I'm sure many of the people on the webinar here, a large part of the audience, over the course of the last many years, we've been hearing more and more about the human microbiome and the importance of key diversity of key microbes, whether they're fungi, whether they're bacteria, not only in our digestive systems, but throughout our bodies, on the surface of our bodies and other places that are really beneficial and key to our overall health, whether it's our status of our immune system or in other mechanisms of fighting off diseases or such things as weight control and things like that. So we're really keying in on bringing about a microbiome approach to improving plant health. That's really one reason why we're in Boston. A lot of people think of Boston as being the hub for innovation in human health, and that ecosystem, that economic ecosystem there has developed a lot of expertise and capability on such things as affordable gene sequencing, affordable machine learning, and ever improving processes and interfaces on how to bring about those technologies together. We're tapping into that. We're tapping into those genome sequencing capabilities and machine learning, but applying it to the plant microbiome instead of human health or even animal health approaches to microbiome. We're really specializing on the plant microbiome, and further focus for what we do is to focus on those microbes, bacteria, those fungi that live and function inside of plant tissues, as opposed to being on the surface of plant tissues or having a certain niche in the soil, maybe outside of the rhizosphere that might impact the plant. But really, we're looking for those microbes that live as endophytes inside of plants in general. Additionally, through our sequencing work and through our machine learning work, through our artificial intelligence, we're trying to identify endophytes that alleviate stress in plants. So there's a whole host of whether that's biotic or abiotic types of stresses, trying to identify those that right now we've been quite successful in identifying microbes that alleviate drought stress or heat stress in crops. Some cases we'll be finding those that are helpful under very cold conditions to help with winter hardiness or enduring periodic unexpected freezes, maybe in the early growing season. There's such things as salt tolerance, nitrogen use efficiency. There are parts of the microbiome that can give us benefits on that, or recovery of nutrients, micronutrients from the soil without having to add additional soil fertility in a fertility program. There are also microbiomes that alleviate biotic stress, whether it's important diseases in our crops or insects or even in some cases outcompeting weeds. So that's what we're looking for. And the outcome of that is I'll first of all point out that we are not a plant breeding company. We're not a crop development company or plant breeding. We do rely on developing really synergistic relationships with the plant breeding crop development industry that's out there. There are many, many choices out there in crop varieties that are available to producers in all five of the crops that we're working on. And we're looking to develop business relationships with those seed providers. And in addition to delivering to a farmer, in addition to delivering these varieties, with our endophytes and those that are yet to come, we'll be able to better bring out the yield potential that already exists in high-quality varieties that are continuously being developed. So we want to be working hand-in-glove with those crop variety developers. A way that we go about doing or obtaining endophytes is to go out in the field. We do prospecting and inspecting of what the crop growth status is, especially under stress conditions, whether it's drought stress, cold, what have you. We examine fields. And when you do that, you're going to identify that occasional plant that just seems to be at a better health status than what its neighbors are. We'll select those plants, or we'll sample those plants along with its less healthy, less flourishing neighbors, and we'll do a comparative study on what the endophyte composition is of those plants, whether it's soybeans or corn or wheat or what have you, of those plants that are growing out in the field. We'll bring those to the lab, and we'll go through our processes of surface sterilization and extraction of endophytes that are living inside of that, and that's where the sequencing begins. Well, we'll do genetic sequencing, gene sequencing of those endophytes that we've extracted. We will take those gene sequences and route that into databases that we can use for machine learning on what synergistic benefits we might come to realize from the presence of those endophytes. And once we find microbes of interest from doing that process, then we'll go through the candidate process of evaluating them for their efficacy inside the laboratory or in the field, whether or not that they can be propagated for our commercial purposes. We'll do further testing on plants of interest in the greenhouse. And then after screening from there and down selection in the greenhouse, then we'll go out in the field in small test plots. And ultimately, we'll work toward doing much larger analysis and performance evaluation of those crops with grower partners, farmer partners that will plant these candidates just to see how they might perform under field conditions. Ultimately, this process takes about 3 years, which, by the way, is substantially quicker, a lot faster than a plant breeding program might be. I know at our university when I was there, it takes about roughly about a 10 year period from the time you make a cross, go through the selection, you advance through the segregation years, and ultimately come out with a variety that you can put in the hands of a grower. I mentioned what our focus is on traits. Certainly, we've been successful, we believe, in drought stress and heat stress, but we'll be looking at developing endophytes for other abiotic and biotic stresses as well. Just a rough idea on what the outcome has been. So if you look at wheat as an example, that's the one that I've been mostly working on. And by the way, since we are a startup company, we're not rolling out it across the country or in all the countries that we're operating. In wheat, we've really been focusing on hard red winter wheat in the southern plains. So that's Kansas, Oklahoma and the Panhandle of Texas. We've been seeing under producer fields, under commercial large farm production, anywhere from about an 8 to 18% increase in yield under stressful conditions. That's over about 30 locations that we've been looking at. Now, I really emphasize that's what we're seeing in stressful locations. We've had a very drought-stressed year in Kansas last year. Those locations that might have been irrigated or well received an abundance of natural precipitation, we really didn't see much of a benefit of our endophytes in those particular cases. But when we had drought stress, we saw plants that had greater seedling vigor. We had about a 10% increase in tiller production, headed tiller production, and then that generally resulted in about a 10% boost in those yield components and an increase in yield of hard red winter wheat. One last comment, and we're seeing other responses in corn, soybeans, cotton, and rice as well. So under these conditions of our first type of endophytes that we're rolling out, we're seeing a consistent and positive benefit to enhancing or capturing more of the yield potential of the varieties that have been used at that point in time. Last comment I want to make is I believe it's very different from how other plant breeding or variety development programs operate, and that is a part of the company is a group of just commercial normal farmers that operate out in the field, and those are called Indigo Partners. Indigo Partners get access to at the earliest stages our technology that they're rolling out, and just we develop testing protocols with them, but we put it in their hands and they plan it. They often do a lot of side-by-sides or more complicated comparisons, but we really rely on them to get a feeling for impact their impressions on how our seed treatments are working for them. Finally, one last thing is we are more than a technology company. The way that we roll out our products, for example, our drought stress products, is to go to farmers in our areas of geography, and we will contract acres with them. And so a part of the contract is that we'll provide seed. They get to make some choices that are offered to them, like on winter wheat, for example. There were 8 different varieties that they knew. They were familiar with these varieties. They dominate the wheat production industry, but they get to choose which varieties that they would like to work with. Indigo will deliver those varieties to their farm for planting season. It'll be certified seed for one. It'll be properly treated with other seed treatments, fungicides, insecticides that are compatible with our endophytes, and then treated with our endophytes. And then after that, provide Indigo agronomists to scout their fields and work with them throughout the growing season. At the time of harvest, we'll buy the crop from them. All of the crop off of those acres that are contracted, plus, and we'll buy that at spot price, and then we'll add on an incentive to that. In the case of wheat, that's 43 cents a bushel. The reason that we're doing that is that we'll own that crop that results from that contract. And we believe that through identity preservation, segregation in the marketplace, not commingling it at elevators, and understanding what the quality traits of that crop are, that we'll be able to market it and capture a higher value to that, to the food industry that's downstream of the farmer. And we're confident in that enough to share that added value up front with the producer. In the case of wheat, that's 43 cents. In the case of corn, the offer that's out there is 47 cents. And for soybeans, it's 51 cents. And we're recently rolling out our offer to rice and cotton as well. So, Ian, that's kind of the nuts and bolts of what we're doing. And I'm really excited about the future that we have ahead of us.
So thank you, Kevin. Fascinating remarks. Thank you very much indeed. A quick question for me. Just you mentioned that typically there's an 8 to 18% increase in yield that you found in one of the examples of where farmers had used your candidate plants. What are the sort of return on investment timeframes that you're aiming for your potential customers then? How long, if they switch to your using your technology, how long before that investment is returned to them in better yields?
Well, I believe that they'll have a return on that investment in the first year. We're not asking for any unique equipment that they'd have to invest in. There's no special preparation for the field other than the use of our technology on the seeds. There might be some changes from what some of the producers do. In the case of wheat, for example, there's often a practice of using bin run seed. We really require certified seed be used. But up front, they know at the time of planting each bag of seed or each seed unit that they're planting is $19 a unit. Now, that's certainly going to be a higher cost than what they might be doing if they've been running just simply bin run seed. But we believe that the combination of using certified seed, the proper seed treatments, in addition to our endophyte, that they ought to be realizing not just a 10% boost that they might get out of our product, but also a 20% boost in yield by using all of these things that are put together. There should be certainly a return on that investment in the very first year, a positive return.
Okay.
Now, one thing I forgot to mention is when seed is provided to them at planting time, they really don't pay for that seed until harvest. And so they essentially have a zero interest loan that they are part of from the time of planting until harvest. It's at harvest time that we'll do the reconciliation on the cost of that seed.
Okay. Right. Thanks very much, Kevin. Just a couple of points. I'm coming over to Ashley from Mars in a sec. But thank you very much to the audience for your questions. There are loads coming in already. Thank you very much indeed. Just one point, and I should have said this at the start. We tend not to have any slides on Innovation Forum webinars. We keep things discussion-based. There are going to be a couple of graphics coming up in a minute when Ashley Allen makes her remarks. But typically, we keep things very much discussion-based. Ashley, Mars, of course, has an ambitious sustainable sourcing plan. Perhaps you can outline how this is being developed and how it's tying in with your wider company aspirations linked to the Sustainable Development Goals and with the development of science-based targets. Ashley.
Yes, absolutely. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. Over to you, Ashley.
Okay, fantastic. Great. Well, hello, everyone. Happy Valentine's Day. As you can imagine, Valentine's Day is a pretty important day for Mars, since we are famously known for our chocolate and confections. And that obviously is a pretty big market on Valentine's Day. So thanks again for joining in. And normally I would ask, if I was in person, for folks to raise their hand if they've had a Mars product today. And then I'd ask, raise a hand if your pet has had a Mars product today. And I can't do that online, but just to kind of give you a little bit of an overview of what Mars is, we aren't just a candy company. We are, in fact, a pet food and now a pet services company as well. We recently acquired Veterinary Clinics of America, and we've operated Banfield Pet Hospitals for a while now. So we have a really large and diverse business, even though some folks think of us immediately as the folks that deliver M&Ms, which is, of course, true. But with that large, diversified business, you can imagine that we source ingredients from all over the world. So we source ingredients from over 80 countries around the world. And we have also several sites around the world that include 100,000 employees from Mars. So we're a really large family-owned business, which means that we have a lot of sustainability implications in both our operations and in our full value chain. So, you know, the way Mars takes on sustainability is really at the core of our values. Two of our core values, responsibility and mutuality, really define our sustainable work. So from the get-go, when Mars was founded over 100 years ago, we put forward the idea that, you know, we need to be responsible for how we do our business and the impact that it has on people, communities, and the environment. And in everything we do, we want to aim for mutual benefits, because we feel as though if we are providing mutual benefits for either the farmers that provide us ingredients, the suppliers that sell them to us, our customers that buy our products, that will in turn provide us greater benefits over the long term. So with that in mind, we really launched into the sustainability world over a decade ago. And we focused at first on our own operations, you know, cleaning up our own house. We set a goal for 100% renewable energy by 2040. We're making great strides toward that. I believe we're at around 25% or so right now, with many years to go. We have a long history of working throughout our supply chain in key commodities, for example, with the cocoa supply chain, to work with suppliers, producers, and scientists to tackle disease and boost yields. So many of the things that Kevin was just mentioning, we've been working on that in key sectors with partners that are experts in that area. And in fact, and Kevin was talking a lot about genome mapping, we worked with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to launch the fully mapped cacao genome just a few years ago. And so that was a big advancement in that area. All that kind of built into this idea that we really needed to tackle sustainability, not just in our operations, but in our full supply chain, if we were going to truly make a difference and truly transform the food industry to make it more sustainable. So just a few months ago in September, we launched our Sustainable in a Generation plan with a focus on three pillars of sustainability. One, a healthy planet, which is what the area that I work in as our climate and land senior manager. And so that's the area I'll really focus on. But also two other pillars, thriving people. So really making sure that everything we do also took into account or also addressed human rights issues, farmer income issues, the rights and livelihoods of the people that work for us or supply us as well, and nourishing well-being. So of course, in the food industry, you know, making sure that we're right on top of things like sugar content and healthy snacks and things like that. So with all that in mind, I want to give you just a little bit of a deep dive into our healthy planet pillar of sustainability and give you a sense in particular on climate change, what that really looks like from a sustainable sourcing perspective. And I'm really happy to take your questions, because we're learning as we go on this. And so we'd love to hear from you on the kinds of questions that you have and also the kinds of reactions and suggestions you have. So please do participate in that. And I look forward to answering your questions. So, if we could pull up the first slide on our climate action footprint and glide path. Our healthy planet pillar includes three goals. One is to have unsustainable water use. The other is to hold land flat, and that's the land that's under our best estimate of the land under agricultural production within our supply chain. And our third goal is to cut our carbon emissions across our full value chain 27% by 2025 and 67% or two-thirds by 2050. So a really ambitious goal. And, you know, we took this on for two reasons. One, I mentioned the idea of responsibility for the planet and for the people that we work with. But the other thing is, you know, climate change, as I'm sure most of you know, really has significant risk implications for companies, all companies really, but especially for those that rely so heavily on the ag sector. And Kevin was mentioning the increased stressful conditions for commodities in the Great Plains and in the U.S. or the Southern Plains. And climate change is expected to worsen those types of stressful conditions around the world. And so that was a real sort of call to action for us to think about that effect when we source from 80 countries around the world. We also recognize that climate change is a global issue. So every one ton of carbon emitted anywhere in the world adds up into the global pool in the atmosphere and then causes implications everywhere. So we really wanted to take that into account as well. So when we started our journey to identify what our climate change target was and then our plan for tackling climate change and taking climate action, we started with mapping our full carbon footprint. And we discovered that our carbon footprint was 26.2 million tons, and this is a 2015 footprint. And that's roughly equivalent, in fact, a little larger than the country of Panama. So that was another wake-up call for us. A company can have the climate footprint of a small country. And this footprint, what was really significant for us, what makes us a little unique, is we included numbers for land use change. So most companies have some sort of sustainability strategy or think about, you know, the effects of deforestation. We actually wanted to quantify that and include that in our carbon footprint. And so we then ended up finding that land use change was about a third of our footprint, which was pretty eye-opening. And then agriculture, so not the part of agriculture that may affect deforestation and things like that, but the actual on-farm practices plus processing, transport, et cetera, made up 46%. So we realized that when we were focusing on our operations and logistics and things like that, we really we're only focusing on a small slice. And so by tackling our full value chain, scopes 1 through 3 carbon emissions, we really were looking at the majority of our footprint that way. If you look at the figure on the right, the sort of ski slope, that just gives you a sense for the level of ambition that we have and then the small slice that our operations goal is of our overall goal. And so we really do have a long way to go, but we are diligently working toward it right away. Okay, if we can move to the next slide. So this is my last slide, and I just wanted to give you a little bit of a sense, taking an idea about our climate action work and how that translates into sustainable supply chain work. So, you know, we set our goal with the Science Based Targets Initiative. It's a consortium of several NGOs that are working with companies. And I think it's over 330 companies now that have science-based climate targets. Focused on reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. And we set that goal as an absolute target over our full value chain. And then we came up with a sort of accounting framework for what we were going to count as far as how to actually reduce that footprint. And so if you look at this table, the two dark blue squares, so the top left and top middle squares, describe some of the actions that we're taking directly within our value chain or sort of indirectly, so kind of linked with our value chain. For example, you know, renewable energy in a national grid, even though we know we don't use the entire national grid to power our operations. That's kind of indirectly in our value chain. And that is most definitely where our area of focus is currently to reduce our carbon footprint. So looking at where can we reduce deforestation within our value chain, enhance energy efficiency, either with our suppliers or within our factories, changing our materials that we source or our sourcing locations. So for example, if we look at what's the impact of sugar coming from beets or from sugarcane and how are the implications there? Changing materials, you could think of, for various oils like palm oil, what are the sort of different sources for oils are there and how can we sort of compare those two? And then for changing locations, you can think about, for example, what sourcing origin for a particular commodity might have a higher yield and therefore a lower land impact or may have a lower risk of deforestation. Now, if you look at the bottom part of this chart, the sort of light blue part, we really also want to look at opportunities for sequestration. So what are the potential for example, improving soil management to improve soil carbon in grains production, wheat, you know, as we've just been talking about, that would then, in fact, build soil build carbon content and actually remove carbon from the atmosphere. How could we sort of promote conservation or forest restoration on farms or agroforestry systems? So that's an area that we're looking at right now and figuring out how could that then add to our carbon budget and really improve our overall carbon footprint. The last thing I'll mention then is just to give you a sense of how specifically Mars is tackling this issue. So we're currently going through a process right now to look at our key commodities. So either those commodities that like cocoa are a big part of our reputation, a big part of our brand, and also that we have either a large market share or that we source significant amounts. So other examples of that are, for example, dairy, sugar, beef, and other proteins for our pet food. So some examples of what we're doing is within each of those commodities, we're looking at really what are the key areas where we can reduce carbon footprint within those commodities, working with our suppliers and also working with, and this is important, key technical partners that can help us through this journey. And for each of those commodities, what we're finding is there's a unique pathway to take. And in fact, with each of those commodities in each sourcing country, there's often a different path to take. In some cases, it means really working on improving yield. And for cocoa, that's pretty clear, clearly a way to improve sustainability in the cocoa sector. In other cases, it's really looking at the deforestation impact, if that's a major issue in that particular commodity. And in other commodities, it's really working with farmers and suppliers to figure out what kinds of improved inputs, improved practices, many of the things that Kevin mentioned, can we work together on to set up the right structure so that those improved practices both improve the sustainability and reduce the carbon for that commodity, but also benefit the farmer and provide things like greater yield, lower input costs, greater resilience or resistance to disease and things like that. So that's where we're at right now. And I am happy to answer your questions and do my best to go into greater detail, but also to, you know, get your suggestions and advice as we move forward.
Sure. Thank you very much, Ashley. Lots of questions coming in. Just a quick one for me before we move into the audience questions. You talk about working with your suppliers. What's the typical reaction you get from suppliers when you bring suggestions of new innovation and technology to the table? And secondly, what sort of time frame do you give them for improvement?
Yeah, thanks. You know, first I'll say there's no one answer to anything because, of course, we have thousands of suppliers around the world. And so with each different supplier or each different material, the conversation's different. You know, our interactions have been very positive so far. And I think, especially at the stage we're at now, we're really looking for where are suppliers either already taking action and need you know, our support or a little boost and things like that. Maybe they're working already through you know, kind of trade associations or collaboratives, and we can sort of feed into that. Or there are peer companies also wanting to address this same issue, and we can go in together and have that conversation. And that in particular has been happening in the cocoa sector. I think many folks probably saw the launch of the Cocoa Forest Initiative with us and several other confectionery companies working directly with suppliers and also the governments of Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana. So it's really a mixed bag, but for now, so far, we've had really positive interactions. And we also try to, of course, do it in a way that really is truly engaging and not just sort of, you know, setting a demand or something like that when we interact with suppliers.
Sure. Well, thank you for that, Ashley. Kevin, turning to you, got a question from our audience. Thinking about the crop varieties that Indigo is producing using your technology, what sort of levels of additional risk assessment are required before they are commercialized?
So we do go through a regulatory process that entails working with agencies, USDA and others in Washington, D.C. However, really a lot of the regulatory aspect is on a state-by-state basis with the respective departments of agriculture that we register our crops with. The reason that's kind of the key part to be focusing in on is that where these endophytes that we developed are naturally occurring organisms. We haven't introduced new organisms into the ecosystem. We've been doing some selections of those that are already there in the crops that we're working with. And so that gives us a regulatory heads up. But nevertheless, we do need to register those for pathogenicity and some other factors that any regulator would want to take a look at. So that's pretty much the process that we go through.
So essentially, it's a sort of case-by-case basis then?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thanks again for everyone for their questions all coming in, quite specifically for each of our speakers, which is probably unsurprising. I'd like to go back to Ashley from Mars. Good question here. You're obviously working to quantify emissions from land use. What models do you use at Mars, Ashley, to calculate emissions from land use change?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. And in fact, that's an area that there's a lot of work going on right now and a lot of, sort of need for refinement and additional work to really fine tune what that land use change picture looks like. Our main source for that is that basically we are taking land use change emissions factors from a group called Qantas. And they've been working a lot over the several years on broader impact factors, so broader environmental impact factors on carbon, on water, et cetera, with this platform called the World Food Life Cycle Analysis Database. And several companies are part of that. And so this is kind of an additional step that they've taken to not only look at the carbon footprint, but also look at the land use change footprint of commodities. And it's a developing body of work, but that's what we've done so far. And so we take those emissions factors and then we look at our traceability information. So how much we source and where we source commodities from, and then use that number to convert that into our land use change footprint. But we currently have some work going on in particular with the cocoa industry to figure out is our sort of, best estimate right now. How accurate is that? Where can we find refinements and things like that? So it's an area where there's a lot more work that needs to be done.
Thank you very much. Just moving on from that, how do you specifically influence the behavior of the farmers with whom you don't have a direct relationship? And how do you measure that over the long term?
Yeah, that's something that... I think we're in the early stages of working that out. There's a lot of different opportunities with existing tools at the farmer level. And so we've looked at Cool Farm tool in some instances, Field to Market tool in other instances, tools that work directly with farmers to kind of survey them on their practices and then convert that into an impact number. So in some instances, it's working at that level. In other instances, we have our own internal GIS model with these impact factors baked in along with our traceability information. And we can use that model to calculate our new footprint or our carbon emissions reductions based on sourcing things from different locations, changing a particular material, or achieving certain levels of reductions with our suppliers.
Thank you very much indeed. Kevin, a different question for you. Again, but coming back to the theme of working with farmers, you mentioned, and it's a question from our audience, you mentioned the increased yields are obviously a direct benefit of using your treated seeds. How does the increased yields fit in with other inputs, whether on fertilizers, herbicides, insecticides, and so on? What typically are the changes in inputs required on that, of those inputs? What are the levels typically that would be required on your treated seeds?
So the yield enhancements that we've been seeing have been irrespective of other inputs that have been going into those crops, at least during what we experienced in the the 2016-2017 harvest of these things. In the case of fertilization, for example, we did see an enhancement of phosphorus uptake in our treated varieties that are out there. We believe that through enhanced root growth, root proliferation, a healthier rhizosphere, among the observations that we're seeing in these, that they're better able to uptake organic forms of phosphorus out of the soil. Now, nitrogen's important. We haven't been providing any additional or added nitrogen, at least thus far, in any of our crops. But since we will be marketing the resulting crop from the growers through these contracts, certainly things, especially in a crop like wheat, protein concentration is a key factor of providing that to downstream millers, bakers, and other processors. So that's where the role of some of our agronomists come in, is to make sure that we have optimum nitrogen fertility management that will be going into these crops to provide that product that consumers are looking for that has a good milling and baking characteristics, and that ties to some extent to what the nitrogen fertility has been. We haven't been adding any other, at least for our first round of products, we haven't been adding anything different in terms of insect control or fungicide control later in the season. That's about the same. But that's actually an area where we're most excited about, because we believe that with future endophyte products that'll be coming out, that will reduce, that'll provide healthier plants that can withstand these various biotic and abiotic stresses. So as we go forward in the future, part of our mission is to reduce those inputs that are going into the crops.
But to reduce them through the development of stronger plants, so therefore they are less susceptible to the challenges from these other, from insects and funguses and so on.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks very much. I want you to go back to Ashley. A couple of questions for Ashley. Really mostly focused on female empowerment, a big issue for many of the events that the Innovation Forum holds. When you're dealing with farmers and also then engaging with the authorities in the countries where you're sourcing from, how much are women engaged at the farm level? And also, how do you then engage with the governments to drive forward changes in female empowerment?
I'm so glad you brought up this topic. Over the next couple of weeks, Mars is actually running a communications campaign related to women's empowerment in science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM. So this has been at the top of my mind because they asked me to put together some material on women and climate change. And so I've been thinking about this particular topic a lot, and hopefully all of you out there will check out our different social media channels at Mars so that you can check out some of that material. This is absolutely an issue at the top of our agenda. I'm not going to say that we have the sort of plan for how exactly that should work at every level. I will say that we absolutely recognize that women's empowerment, both at the farm level and at the, I would say, kind of decision maker level, is especially important, and that it's important on both sides of the coin. So both in the sense that big global challenges like climate change and other environmental issues often disproportionately affect women because women are making a lot of the household decisions, and I'm particularly seeing right now in agricultural communities and in particular in developing countries, they're often, growing the food for the family or procuring the food for the family. In some cases, they may be the ones, gathering firewood if that's part of that culture, or gathering water if it's a culture that has to gather water. And so all of these environmental challenges tend to impact them more. But it's not only that. I mean, we also see that why how could you possibly come to a solution on challenges this big without really mobilizing everyone that could be a positive agent of change around these issues? And so if you're not looking at 50% of the population, 50+% of the population that women make up, how could you possibly come to solutions on these issues? So we've recognized that, we're working with it. We're currently developing a way to kind of make sure that we're incorporating both screening for gender-related issues, but also incorporating gender empowerment into our sourcing strategies. We haven't, I don't think, fully determined how to do that yet, but it is something that we're absolutely working on.
Thank you very much indeed. And also, just in terms of government engagement very quickly, how do you engage with governments directly to deal with these issues, the broader sustainable agriculture issues?
Yeah. Well, one good example of that is in the cocoa industry. So I mentioned this cocoa and forest initiative. For an industry like cocoa, where there really are just a handful of key countries that produce 80% of the world's cocoa, and where we have a major influence as a big buyer of cocoa and is something where it's really integral to the products that we're known for, we work directly with the ministries of agriculture, in some cases the ministries of environment, if that's relevant, to identify what are the barriers to things like tackling deforestation or promoting sustainable ag, but in particular, I think deforestation, and then identify what types of partnerships we need to make that happen. So in the Cocoa Forest Initiative example, we actually developed an MOU, and you can imagine how difficult this is, between several companies, including us, several sort of environmental leadership organizations, the World Cocoa Foundation, which coordinated it all, and the governments of both Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana to set a joint commitment that we would tackle deforestation together in this industry, because it takes both, you know, companies that create the demand for these products, but also the governments that are responsible for enforcement and regulation related to, you know, the forest areas and agricultural practices to actually make it work. So that's one example where we're working directly with governments. I think in other situations, you know, in countries where we have operations, we are absolutely tracking the policy environment around agriculture, around energy, and things like that. And we sort of step into that arena on a case-by-case basis. You know, when it makes sense for us to advocate for a particular policy or to you know, engage with lawmakers on a particular piece of legislation, then we absolutely will do so. One example is in the U.S., we've regularly been talking to lawmakers at the national level, so you know, in Congress. But we've also had some conversations at the local level, for example, in Virginia, on renewable energy access and why, you know, we prioritize that and what, you know, what elements sort of improve our ability to source renewable energy. In another instance, we, when the U.S. announced that the U.S. administration announced that they intended to pull out of the Paris Agreement, we stepped up and said, you know, we are very supportive of the U.S. staying in the Paris Agreement. We are still in. In fact, we are all in on this issue. And we've been very vocal about that. So it's a really case-by-case basis on how we interact, but very much that's part of our strategy.
Great. Well, thank you. I mean, certainly the West African Cocoa Initiative did really feel like the value chain really put its hand up. But we'll need to deliver because everyone will be watching. Certainly something that we'll be keeping an eye on at Innovation Forum. I would like to put a question to both speakers now, and I'll turn to Kevin first. Kevin, what for you at Indigo Ag, what do you think is the future for agriculture to move from being a source of greenhouse gas emissions to being a sink for carbon? Kevin.
Well, that goes back to my background beyond my 10 years thus far at Indigo. And I think agriculture must play a key role in doing exactly what it is you're talking about, whether it's figuring out the puzzle or the challenges of things like conservation tillage and no-till, whether it's about enhancing through sustainable intensification crop production in areas where it belongs, but maybe stepping back and re-examining the role of other lands that are into, maybe they're highly erodible or whatever, they're into agricultural production, but they might, from an ecosystem, global ecosystem standpoint, maybe they might serve a better role in land coverage, wildlife habitat, those types of things that capture greenhouse gases, especially CO2, and lock them in. I still believe there seems to be a step back, and there's been some pushback of interest in the role of agriculture and things like ag-based renewable energy. That debate certainly still continues, but I believe agriculture has a key role to play in our energy portfolio that we have in any country, especially whether it's the United States, and including cellulosic sources, cellulosic conversion. That's going to be very tough to do as long as we have a relatively inexpensive source of petroleum. But we need to continue to develop our technologies in the research center so that when the time comes, or as the time emerges, for us to be becoming more reliant on cellulosic forms of liquid fuels or power or what have you, that we can bring that about in an effective manner. And that, in turn, the whole point of that, the whole expectation of those types of activities, is to enhance our greenhouse footprint across the country and in agriculture.
Thanks. Thank you, Kevin. Yeah, certainly energy pricing will be a big issue around how the development of alternative fuels will come about. Ashley, can I put the same question to you? And very quickly, please, I want to get one more question before the end of our hour.
Okay, I'm sorry to make it longer, but can you please repeat it? Because you cut out for me a little bit when you asked the question.
What do you see as the opportunities for agriculture to go from being a source of greenhouse gas emissions to becoming a carbon sink?
Uh-huh. Oh, great. Okay, so two-word answer, soil carbon. So we're really interested in unlocking this soil carbon issue and identifying what impact that really has on agriculture's carbon footprint. There's been some studies that have said, enhancing soil carbon in certain agricultural areas can, in fact, reduce the carbon footprint by 800% for some commodities. And others say that I think it's like you can sequester a net negative ton per hectare. So there's a lot of work going on in the potential for soil carbon sequestration and how different practices you can do on farm can enhance that, which also improves soil quality, improves soil health, and therefore improves yield. But there seems to still be a bit of work to do on what is the consensus around that, and specifically, what are the recommendations for the private sector to make that change happen?
Okay, thank you. Right, final question for both panelists. Just to wrap up, how will you measure the success of your activity in the sustainable agriculture sector and the innovation you've got in that place? Kevin, how will you measure success?
Well, our number one, and I don't think that our mission statement is necessarily ranked, but enhancing farmer profitability is in every business conversation, every decision that we make in the company. So measurably improving on-farm profitability in our geographies, our target areas, and in our crops is certainly an important measure.
Thank you. And Ashley, to you.
Yeah, I think, you know, ultimately, and this is kind of along the lines of what Kevin said, ultimately, it's about the people. So ultimately, our success is measured by both how successful Mars is, how successful our associates are, and how successful we are at attracting talent, but also how successful the farmers are that supply us, and so that we can really secure long-term sustainable relationships with these suppliers and farmers that benefit us both for years to come. Now, underneath that, there will be a whole list of metrics that we're tracking, you know, on an annual basis, like GHGs, water usage, energy efficiency, and things like that. But really, it's all about the success of our business and the success of the people that we work with.
Thank you very much. Okay, we are out of time. I'm going to have to stop the discussion now. first of all, though, please, I would like to thank our panel very much for their time and insight. Once again, if you'd like to continue the debate on how innovation and technology can make agriculture sustainable, then please do join us in DC in April. We will send you a recording of this webinar so you can listen to it again at your leisure and share with your colleagues. Thank you very much for all the questions. I'm going to, after the webinar, I'm going to put them all to our two speakers and try to get some answers out of them. No promises about what we'll be able to get back, but I will try. We'll get them to our speakers and we'll get some answers to the unanswered questions to you, I hope. We always welcome feedback, so please don't hesitate to contact us with any comments you have or any follow-up questions. But for now, I hope you found the past hour interesting. We certainly covered a lot of ground. Thanks for listening and happy St. Valentine's Day.